Here's what you can look forward to on this episode of the Nice Guys on Business.
A big reason that we created the idea of not just selling insurance, but really making it a membership organization where it's kind of two parts of the transaction. Sure, you get a quote or buy a car and we insure it, but you join the Hagerty Drivers Club ideally. And you know, that's how you get the magazine. You get invited to all these cool events, all that sort of stuff. It's really meant to create community.
If my calculations are correct, when this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see the Nice Guys on Business podcast. Running a business is hard. Being a business leader is even harder. The Nice Guys bring in top industry pros to help your business prosper in a tough world. Get real advice from real people to get you real results today. Now it's time for the Nice Guys on Business. Here's your host, Doug Sandler and Strickland Bonner.
So if you've ever been in the car collectible world, for even a short period of time, you've heard the name Hagerty, probably from multiple sources and for multiple reasons. For me personally, Hagerty represents trustworthiness, a pristine reputation for fairness and premiums as an insurance provider, and truthfulness in classic valuation as well. Plus, they put out a way cool publication for the Drivers Club and have a kick-ass drive share program that actually has put dollars into my pocket and provides so many value adds that I am super stoked to talk to today's guest, McKeel Hagerty, their CEO. McKeel, I'm excited to have you here. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I love that introduction. Awesome.
Well, I'm a huge fan. I mean, I've been a fan since day one. I mean, literally before I bought my 65 Mustang, never heard the word Hagerty before. As soon as I buy or even was interested in the car, you guys were the only name that I even considered. I didn't even know there was others in the insurance game. And then when I found all the value add stuff and then this drive share thing on top of it, I feel like value add. Was that the purpose all along, or was it just to put insurance into people's pockets so that you could obviously grow a business?
Well, you know, I don't know if it was the purpose all the way along. Like, you know, anybody who's ever run a startup or a small company, you know, at first it's sort of, how do you survive? How do you make money? That sort of thing. And, you know, insurance as an industry, when you really get it rocking and rolling, like it's a great business because it's, you know, recurring revenue. You kind of build each year on your past successes. It's pretty awesome that way. But it is not always super sexy to talk about, you know, just like as a normal consumer conversation, people would rather talk about the next iPhone or new cars that are coming out and all that. So a big part of, I guess, probably my temperament is when it comes to competition, I've always wanted to like have the game won before I got to the race. Yeah. Right. And, you know, so for me, it kind of goes to the second part of what you said, which is the, you know, the more value you can add, you kind of win before you start, and you combine those magic items together. And that's kind of how our business model works.
Well, and you guys have made it so easy too. I mean, as a customer of yours and as someone that has, you know, like yesterday, I'm at I see this ad for an F-250 pickup truck. And I'm like, oh, I want to have that. And then I didn't see myself making it down to past Palm Springs to get it, but I finally made my way over there and I'm like, I want to buy this. And then as I'm thinking about driving away, I'm thinking, well, I got to have this insured. Literally in 5 minutes worth of time, I had a binder on my, or whatever you call it, on my car. And I'm driving away with this guy. I wrote a check and now I have this Ford F-250 in my driveway. It's 67. And I'm like so excited about it. And you guys made it so easy. How is it over all of these years that you've been able to, you know, problem resolution? You guys have come up with the solution so many times. Was that again part of the plan, or is that just the customer experience?
I think like in the early days of the business, I mean, this business literally started in the basement of the house I grew up in Northern Michigan, and the idea early on was that we never benchmarked ourselves against insurance providers or people's expectations of financial services. You know, back in those days, and say even in the early 90s, you know, we were looking at, I know it sounds a little dated now, but companies like L.L. Bean or Nordstrom or other businesses that were kind of known for having extraordinary service, solving problems, you know, kind of over delivering when the expectations were low. And I think those are probably the companies not those two in particular, but the types of companies that I always modeled ourselves after, which is, wow, how does somebody take something that's kind of relatively unsexy and make it totally different. I've met Richard Branson a couple of times, and you know, you think what he did with Virgin Airways, and you know, same airplanes, right? Two manufacturers, yep, of the same airplanes. Everybody mm-hmm. uses them, you know, for the big long haul stuff. Same airports, everybody uses them, and yet a Virgin experience is completely different. Right. And why? Right. You know, it's creativity. It's a willingness to solve problems differently. It's hiring people differently. That's just what you do.
You know, you mentioned something that you were in the basement of your home. So talk to our community of entrepreneurs that are out there, and even the collectors. Talk about the origin story of Hagerty. I'm really curious about how that basement grew to the huge organization that you have today.
Well, thank you. Yeah, my mom and dad. My dad originally was a hometown Main Street insurance agent. You know, sold all lines of insurance products. He was good at it. And my mom and dad later worked together in that business, but I was a car guy, and I was big into vintage boating. You know, we live in Northern Michigan, lots of lakes around. And so if he wasn't working on a car project in the garage, it was a boat project. And they sold that original business kind of with the idea of, okay, you know, what can we do? They were in their, you know, early 50s. And it was a couple of core ideas. They knew insurance was a good business. I mentioned all of that. They knew they wanted to do it with something that was more fun. You know, insuring some of the, you know, kind of more mundane stuff isn't that fun. Mm-hmm. And so they landed on wooden boats of all things. And they said, hey, look, if we could have a national wooden boat insurance program, we could spend our summers traveling around to cool boat shows. We could meet cool people. We'd have spread a geographic risk. We'd build a business that was big enough that could survive economic downturns, which they had been through a couple of them in the 70s. So some of those core ideas still exist today. I was about 13, I guess, when it started, or 13, 14. And my sisters and I all worked in the business, and it kind of grew up 8-9 people in the basement of the house. And, you know, we'd all talk about business over the dinner table, and all of my sisters and I kind of went our separate ways, went to college, grad school, so on, and never thought we'd go back to it. And we started we went from wooden boats into the classic car business, just because we thought it could be kind of fun, kind of a product extension almost. Mm-hmm. Lots of wooden boat owners had cars. And all of a sudden you realize, oh my gosh, this is a big market and we're pretty good at this. I was getting my doctorate at the time. I didn't finish in philosophy. And I said, okay, I could take a couple of years working the business until I really figure out what I'm going to do. 1995, move back, and started kind of taking over. And that's the origin, you know, but it was really our real big unlock came after, which was, you know, that's kind of like what we did, but it's the how we did it that changed, when I had a bunch of these big aha moments. And one of them was, you know, working with this genius of advertising, two guys actually out of Chicago, and they convinced us that we should run ads that never use the word insurance in it, that we should just talk about kind of the fun of cars mm-hmm. and the fun of driving, and kind of poke fun at, you know, goofy guys who have cars and how crazy they are about them. And so never mentioned insurance. And it really kind of started this big ramp up of, you know, how we were growing. And then a couple of years after that, I was at the Nike headquarters. You know, I joined YPO, which is I'm a big advocate for entrepreneurs out there. Find a peer group to join. EO, there are a bunch of them. YEO. I joined YPO, which is for slightly bigger companies. And I was meeting a bunch of the C-suite executives there. And of course, you're completely intimidated with a small business. You know, they've got Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan and all these huge, you know, athletes that they support. And you think, well, I could never do that stuff. And the CEO at the time came out and gave this kind of presentation on how they think about what Nike does. And at one point he uses this phrase. He said, it doesn't matter who our athletes are or how much we spend on sponsorship or support. He said, we're about the spirit of sport. And wherever there is the spirit of competition or people trying to get better or go faster, he said, that's where Nike needs to be. And it was like a lightning bolt struck me, because I thought, you know what? Here I am in this like competitive insurance environment trying to grow the family business. If I would just made this more about the spirit of the love of the cars and how people love and enjoy cars, I'd never have to talk about insurance again. And the growth will just take care of itself. And it's really, it's been an amazing ride since then.
Well, I remember having several conversations, and I come back before I even bought my car. I remember talking to a couple of guys over at NPD, National Parts Depot, Rick Schmidt's organization. And then I've subsequently had conversations with Rick. And it was like every time I call their company, I'd spend, you know, 20, 30 minutes on the phone with the guy on the other side of the phone or the woman on the other side of the phone talking about their love of the car, not only that I have, the 65 Mustang convertible that I have, but their love of their car as well. And every time I have called Hagerty and had the conversation with, no matter who it is, they're all car enthusiasts too. I mean, you talk about the love of the industry. I mean, your team, I feel like they're intricately involved, not just in selling insurance or being the customer service person, but they all love cars too. Was that by design?
Well, I think it was a happy confluence. You know, we ended up growing so fast, you know, and insurance is a pretty people intensive business that if we only hired people who were totally passionate about cars, we would have had a hard time scaling. But what we've actually discovered is that we kind of create this updraft of the love of cars, even within Hagerty. So yes, we have some of the world's automotive experts who work with us now, but I can't tell you the number of people who got here, started learning, fell in love with it, and bought cars of their own. We actually have this little rule, which is anytime a team member buys a car and insures it with us, I get an email. and, you know, a picture of it from the underwriting department. And, you know, here, so-and-so in this office bought a car with her husband, and she's super excited about it. And I always send an email back. I love it. You know, congratulations. Can't wait to see that one. And, you know, usually it's as much as 3 to 5 cars per week that our team members buy. So it's a pretty awesome thing. And we're just kind of part of that world. And, you know, I even think now, like, I think we had 4 or 5 employees who were judges on the show field at the Pebble Beach Concours this year. Wow. You know, no organization has that kind of expertise resident.
Yeah,
we're really lucky.
Totally. Your roots go deep, not only in length of time, but in width also in the people that work for your organization. And you feel that. You feel it when you talk to anybody in your organization. You feel it whenever you get an email back. You feel it when, you know, I'm holding a copy of the Drivers Club magazine right now, and I've had a conversation or two with Colin Comer, and just enjoy the fact that they enjoy the industry so very much. And that's got to make an impact on your bottom line. I always think that the organization is not made up of the products that you sell. It's made up of the people that you have within your organization. And do you feel that is the same way with your team?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you have to give people the freedom to let, like you describe, conversations lengthen out, for people to share stories. We have this garage space, kind of a warehouse up in Traverse City, Michigan, where we're located. We have a smaller one in Colorado where we have employee restoration projects going on. And we have usually a couple of cars at any given time, either being disassembled or reassembled. And, you know, not in the height of our busiest season, which is typically summer, but, you know, in the fall, winter, and team members can sign up and go over there and learn to work on cars. And many of these people have never used tools even before, you know, like shop tools. And, you know, before you know it, they're welding and getting to work on stuff. And, you know, many of the cars will have 100, 150 people who laid hands on it during the restoration process. And so when it comes out and they get to drive it or ride in it, depending on their interest, and in the end, it's pretty powerful. And my whole view is that if that translates into one more conversation on the phone or at a car event where they say, "Hey, I worked on a 65 Mustang once," and that's pretty cool. You know, then we win. Everybody wins.
Well, what I love best about the community is the togetherness and the cohesiveness of the community. I've had this podcast, Ford Mustang, the Early Years podcast, one of the other shows that I do, and we'll probably simulcast this on that show as well. We have about 1,000 people that queue up and listen to that show. And anybody that's listened to it for any short period of time knows that my biggest skill set is taking the bucket from the garage and making it sure it's filled with water and soap and washing the car. Has nothing to do with getting under the hood, although I have tried my hand because of this amazing community. I wouldn't have purchased the F-250 yesterday if it wasn't for someone in my community that had helped me. He literally FaceTime. I'm going under the car, showing all of the things under the car so that people can see, so he could see, Jonathan could see if I had an oil leak or if there was any rust. And he's like, no, this is a solid car. I mean, the community really has helped me grow my podcast. And I'm assuming the same thing happens, you know, good people refer great businesses. And I think that that has happened with Hagerty as well. Are you finding the same thing?
Yeah. A big reason that we created the idea of not just selling insurance, but really making it a membership organization where it's kind of two parts of the transaction. Sure, you get a quote or buy a car and we insure it, but you join the Hagerty Drivers Club ideally. And you know, that's how you get the magazine. You get invited to all these cool events, all that sort of stuff. It's really meant to create community, exactly the way you describe it. Our evaluation tools, which is really, you know, a leading place that anybody can find data. It's the largest sets of data around how cars are valued. We wanted to give those tools to people because people are always shopping for cars. Even if you have your dream car, you know, you see something cool drive by you and you're like, sure, I wonder what one of those would be mm-hmm. worth, you know? Mm-hmm. And most people come to the valuation, our valuation tools, and then, you know, dream about buying it someday. And it's this kind of community driven stuff that's why we did it, you know, just to drive that kind of fun activity.
Let's put the business away for a quick second and talk about the stuff that probably a lot of people, unless they're actually reading, I forget the name of it, the rear view. Is that what's the name of your articles on the final? Yeah. So
yeah, the rear view mirror, a couple of different names,
yeah, which are great. That's where I generally start with your rear view. That's the first place I look in the magazine, the last page. And then I go over to Colin's article if he's written one that month. I'd love to chat about for a second you as the collector rather than you as the CEO of Hagerty. So, mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about what I'm assuming family love got you started in that. And that's where it continued or was there something else?
Yeah. My dad, you know, as I described it, was a car guy and he was a do-it-yourselfer, could kind of work on anything. I was working on cars in the shop. And with my older sisters and I, we all got to restore a car with my dad in our early teens. So oldest sister restored a Corvair Lakewood station wagon. Middle sister restored a 1960 Porsche that she bought out of the newspaper for a few $100. And I restored with my dad a 1967 Porsche 911S that I paid $500 for. And which everybody's like, oh my God, $500. Well, it was pretty far gone. And it was the, you know, early 80s. But I still had that car. And so that, you know, whenever people say like, boy, I think you have some cool cars, but what's your favorite? And I say, okay, well, it's really not a fair question. For me, my favorite will always be that one. Mm-hmm. Drove it yesterday. And, you know, it's just kind of there, but I have very broad interests in cars. So I have some of my dad's cars that range from a, you know, 33 Ford truck. You talked about your Ford. He was a big Ford guy. So we had a bunch of different kinds of Fords, different eras, so, you know, vintage Cadillacs from a, in 1957, 1960. But then I was like, I also like pre-war classics. So I like Cadillacs. So I always wanted a Cadillac 16, bought a 1931 Cadillac 16 cylinder, which is super cool. You know, people say, is it fun to drive? I'm like, absolutely not. Like there's nothing fun to drive about it. It's cool to drive, but it's not that fun. It's
a big
gigantic car. Right. But you know, my probably preference of types of cars are just, you know, cars that were meant to be kind of fast for their day. So I have a Mustang too. Like you described, mine's a Shelby GT500 67. Mm-hmm. That's I describe it as one of the most fun ways to turn gasoline into great noise. that, you know, it's loud and growling and super fun and fast. And so yeah, I've been really, really blessed to build a, you know, nice collection. It changes a little bit over time. I'm much, much more interested in cars that I can use on driving events or tours. I don't race really. I kind of started to get into that when I was younger in my career, and I just don't live near enough a track to practice and be safe and feel confident. So I like some of the tours with other car people, and so that's what I'm most interested in right now.
So tell me about two things. One, tell me about the car that got away that you never had a chance to buy, and the car that you wish you never sold. Do you have a story about each one of those?
Yeah. So I always remember it was years ago. Well, let's see. I can tell you precisely. It was 2000, spring of 2000, and I was kind of having a tough year. You know, business wasn't great. Kind of, you know, not feeling very great that year financially. And I was at we used to sponsor one of the auctions, auction companies that's not around anymore, the Cruise Auctions. So I was down in Fort Wayne, Indiana, standing up on the auction block. I knew the auctioneers and just kind of watching the cars go by and listening to the noise, watching people bid. And a 1967 Ferrari 330 GTC came up on the little rotisserie, and it's up there. And the bidding is just dead. You know, nobody's bidding on this thing. I mean, it's like barely getting above 50 grand, mm-hmm. 55, 57. And the auctioneer just to the crowd said, McKeel, you got to buy this car and bring it back to Traverse City, you know, my hometown. And I'm like, I just kind of like hung my head. Like, first of all, I wouldn't buy a car like that sight unseen. You know, second thing is I didn't have the money. And so it sold for 72 grand. Mm-hmm. That day, turns out I had to go look at it. Sure enough, numbers matching. 330 GTC, not everybody's dream Ferrari, but it was a legit Ferrari, 1967 red, the whole thing. And it sold for 150 a month later, like 300 a year after that. And I think last time I tracked it down, it sold for 600 grand. So that's one I wished I'd bought. I just, you know, called the bank or done something, figured out how to get
it out. Right.
Yeah. Figured it out. You know, we've been pretty lucky. My dad never really sold anything, so not too many got sold along the way. There was, We did have a 66 big block Corvette when I was quite young that I wish he hadn't sold. He wishes he didn't sell it either. But ironically, it was the 1970s. And when there was a period of time when the gas stations ran out of premium gas, and that car just did not run well on, you know, regular soon to be kind of coming unleaded gasoline. So he traded it for a Bronco, 1974 Bronco. So, yeah, you see it. Now the Bronco's pretty cool now, but I'd rather have the Corvette.
So, hey, look, anyway. The Broncos, it's amazing what has been going on. And let's talk about that for a second, not just about Broncos, but talk about classic car values for a second. Yep. Are they, you know, when you see a car and not taking anything away from Bullitt's sale at 3.4 or 3.7, whatever it was, $1 million. But is it getting out of hand with car values and what they're getting at the auctions these days?
Well, you know, the car, what I always try to remind people is that car auctions are super, they're super fun. They're kind of sexy. It's like absolutely amazing how much money gets spent on them, but it's this tiny tip of the iceberg of how many cars actually sell. Like mm-hmm. the vast majority of cars do not sell at auction, even on these digital platforms now. They sell privately. They may get connected online, but they don't sell through an auction mechanism. They sell through, you know, ads. Kind of like you bought your truck.
Right.
And so when you look at the big broad market, it's certainly up over the years. You know, these, you know, there's a new generation with, you know, feeling pretty flush. They're paying more for cars, but it's not as crazy as it looks at, like in the big auction market. Now at the top end, yeah, for sure. And I will tell you, you know, and when you talk about six figure cars worth hundreds of thousands or even millions. And really what that is though, I tell people it's about limited supply. There just aren't very many. So let's say you had the greatest year of your life. You sold a big, you know, a house and you want to spend money on a car. Like you could say like right now today, I want to buy a real legit Shelby Cobra. Well, there aren't any for sale. I mean, you could say, well, yeah, but I have the money. Well, tough. Nobody's selling one today. No one. And so that's the challenge that people don't quite get. So when one comes up for sale, the four or five people who are in that same spot, they're bidding on them at auction. And that's why they seem sometimes kind of crazy. So it's just a tiny tip of the iceberg. But back to the Bronco story, if I can, for just a second.
Yeah, sure.
That's the hottest part of the market right now. Next generation, you know, what they're interested in, obviously cars from the 80s and 90s, sports cars are really taking off. You know, those are cars, you know, or people who like them are sort of in their 40s and 50s. And then those kind of early off-road or four-wheel drive vehicles, so Broncos, Scouts, Land Rovers, you know, all of that kind of stuff, early Blazers, that's what people want. I actually have an early Bronco, and I now know why so many people modify them, because they didn't have very good suspensions. They just weren't very good, but they look cool as could be.
Well, I see with EVs, with electronic vehicles becoming so much more popular now, because, you know, I think my last fill up, I think I spent $6.99 a gallon. I'm in Southern California, so
California,
it ain't cheap. That the collectible world is even blossoming even more. People don't want to let go. I'm a 57-year-old guy that just loves the cars that I grew up with in the 70s and 80s. And I just love the idea of holding on to, or even a classic for me, getting back into the 60s, which was an old car for me, even in the 80s when I started driving. But the whole idea that these EVs coming on the scene, the classic world is just completely blossoming. And I see that doing great things for your business. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I think you're going to see this, you know, you're going to see like a couple of interesting paths. One is, you know, with EVs, or even just sometimes, you know, even with internal combustion cars, you can get into eras where they're not always as attractive as others. Now, I think right now, some of the modern performance cars are probably some of the best looking cars ever. They're high quality, even the, you know, lesser known brands, or, you know, I would say like, hey, look, a Kia Stinger could wax my 67 911 around the track, and they're pretty attractive, right? So, you know, they break, their quality, you know, all of it, and who cares if it's a Kia or not, they're awesome. And, you know, I think, you know, with the coming of electrification, you're going to see kind of three things. One, the high performance electric cars are going to be totally just wicked because they're so fast. They're super cool. I think you're going to see the electrification of certain sorts of vintage cars. And it's not exactly my jam, but I get it. And if like my kids would only own one, if that's, you know, what they had under the hood, then I think we're fine. And then for those who, you know, love that original feeling, that authenticity, it's going to drive the demand for internal combustion engine cars up. And our job is to be good stewards of all of it. You know, and recognize that we've been repowering cars for decades in all sorts of different ways. And our job is just to make sure that people are out there having fun with them.
And in my stage of the game, my job is just to buy up as many of those cars inexpensively and either rent them out for $350 a pop or sell them at a high profit. So
there you go.
I'm excited just to enter into the collectible world with a second vehicle. I think it's totally, totally cool. Hey, I know I only have a moment left with you, and I want to talk before we wrap up just about, you know, you're on the who's who list of those notables in the classic car community. Even if you don't feel that way, we feel that way on the other side, looking at the list of who's who's. Who have you had a chance to, you know, kind of, you know, rub elbows with, turn some wrenches with, or maybe just hang out with and having coffee or lunch or a glass of wine? You know, the Jay Lenos, the Fords, who have you had a chance to hang out with? And I don't want to ask you who your favorites are, but who are you impressed with?
Yeah, it's really, you know, it's so much fun to talk about the cars, but I always remind people it's car people that make the car world go around. And I've been really blessed to meet, you know, so many leaders of car companies, designers, racers, you know, certainly not all of them, you know, but many, many of them, from, you know, spending real time with the Sterling Mosses of the world and, you know, some of those types of people on the racing end. I mean, you know, Carol Shelby, my wife and I both knew Carol Shelby kind of separately, because it was before we were married. And, so we both saw Ford versus Ferrari, you know, it was really fun. It was like, you know, imagining Matt Damon as Carol again. Yeah. That was pretty cool. But yeah, you know, Jay Leno has been a great friend of Hagerty and an advocate, and he's such a lovely lover of cars. He's extremely knowledgeable, like legitimately extremely knowledgeable, and kind of doesn't tolerate fools in the space. So if you you kind of have the ability to have an honest, real conversation about cars, it's really fun to talk to him. And he's been such a high profile advocate for us. So, man, I'll tell you, you know, when I take my last lap some day far out into the future, it's going to be, yeah, the cars are cool, but it'll be the people that I reflect on the most.
Yeah. I am excited to continue reading, now that we've had a chance to chat, your column in the Drivers Club magazine, and even more be a proponent for the things that you do and your company. McKeel, I so appreciate you being on the show today. Thanks for sharing your wisdom and your company and your story with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a great conversation. Thanks for the kind comments and enjoy that new old truck.
I know. I'm so excited. It's leaking oil right now, but I know that that's just a gasket or two or whatever to fix it. And I'm sure I can hire somebody to do that because I don't know how to do that.
Well, as they say, a little bit of oil on the floor is a sure sign that there's oil in the engine.
Yeah, that is very true. Thanks for being here and thanks for sharing. And if you ever decide to start a podcast, I know you do some, you've done some mm-hmm. Some stuff on YouTube. I've seen. Have you done your podcast yet or not yet?
No. I mean, we've thought about it. I love talking to car people and people around the business world and leaders, and we're thinking about it. So
excellent. Well, keep us in mind. I'm happy to produce the show for you, and thank you so much for sharing your wisdom on the show today.
Thanks. All the best.
Hey, Ford Mustang community and Nice Guy community, thanks for hanging out with us another day. Ford Mustang community, keep it safe, keep it rolling, and keep it on the road. Until next time.
For the Nice Guys on Business, and in accordance with my court-mandated community service, I'm Steve O'Brien. Only 27 more voiceovers to go, and then maybe they'll let me leave the state. And take this ankle bracelet off.